At the time, I became friends with Seth MacFarlane. He came up to me and says, you know, I came into some money recently. Is there any good I can do? And I said, oh my gosh, why don't you, you know, fund a pilot for Cosmos so we can show people what it's going to look like.
Welcome to Story and Craft. Now, here's your host, Mark Preston.
All right, here we go. Back again, Story and Craft. How are you? I'm Mark. Pleasure to have you here. If you're coming back another episode, thank you so much for joining me once again. If you're brand new, this is your first episode. Boy, did you choose a good one to check out. Thank you for stopping by. This episode, Neil deGrasse Tyson. He doesn't need an introduction. I mean, who doesn't know Neil deGrasse Tyson? Astrophysicist from the Hayden Planetarium and just a real cool personality. Really enjoyed this chat. We discussed a lot of things. Of course, his new book, Welcome to the Universe in 3D, a visual tour. Kind of an interactive book. We'll discuss that. Also, just generally his origin story. What kind of sci-fi movies he enjoys. Which ones does he think are on point and accurate, scientifically speaking? And, of course, we're going to discuss Carl Sagan and the chance meeting he had with Seth MacFarlane that brought Cosmos back to TV. And if you want to learn anything at all about Story and Craft, send me a message, voicemail, sign up for the newsletter, follow on social media. Easy, easy. All you got to do is go to storyandcraftpod.com. Once again, storyandcraftpod.com. Follow the show, if you will. Like, leave a review. I mean, just love the fact you're here. Thanks so much for being a part of the mischief that I am stirring up twice a week now. Don't forget Tuesdays and Thursdays. We are releasing an episode. Let's get right after it. It is Neil deGrasse Tyson Day right here on Story and Craft. Well, Dr. Tyson, thank you for taking time out.
Neil, please.
I got to be honest. I did very little prep for this because I'm like, I don't want this to be an interrogation. I'm going, okay, Mark, you can ask a gazillion questions you really want the answers to. And it was really funny. My daughter, Emma, my 16-year-old, we were talking. I was like, you know, I got some interviews. Got to talk to actors, directors. Like, who do you think I should talk to? She grew up, as well as my other two kids, on Cosmos. And she's like, okay. Neil deGrasse Tyson. I was like, obviously. So here we are. So my 16-year-old executive producer just arranged. Mm-hmm. But well, congratulations on the new book. What a cool idea for a book, though. 3D visual tour.
Yeah, it was a little bit audacious because in a world of very high production value visualizations in movies and TV and immersive video games, so to have like this thing, which is kind of a retro technology. It's two images merged into one in your brain with the help of this viewer. But people don't do this with cosmic objects, right? And we did it with cosmic objects. So the moon pops, and the moon goes from being a picture of the moon to being a place called the moon that is there in front of you, and it becomes more real and visceral, and you end up feeling the universe in addition to thinking about it. And I think that's its value. Just welcome to the universe in 3D. By the way, as I said on that show, we decided kind of at the last minute that I would narrate every caption and load that up to bonus content in the welcometotheuniverse.net webpage. And in that bonus content, as you go through one picture at the next, and then I use my planetarium voice to narrate each caption. So
that brings up a really interesting point. My kids are like, is he always like that in interviews? I was like, because they're so used to you on Cosmos being this wonderful narrator, this tour guide, as it were. I was like, no, I love his enthusiasm. And like, that's Neil deGrasse Tyson that I've grown to love. And they're like, wow, that's kind of cool.
He's still kind of a kid. Yeah, I mean, Cosmos, there's so much that had to come together to make that work. We thought of possibly filming it, just me ad-libbing all the content, but the timing of everything had to fit with the animations, with the special effects, with the narrations above other storytelling. All that was this huge puzzle that had to fit together. So every word had to fit the timing perfectly, and so that's what we did.
It reminded me of something. I was 7, maybe 8 years old, somewhere between 6 and 8, we'll call it that. And of course, at that point in time,
we're the same age probably. So I'm thinking I'll remember whatever, if it's a social, cultural thing, I'd be right in the middle of that.
Well, it was actually just kind of it was a personal thing because, you know, you're young, you see the sun, you see the moon, you know, it's there. And I remember my parents got me a hardback book. It was about yay big. It was, you know, big, big glossy cover and had these, is a big picture book. It wasn't kind of cartoony illustrations, but of the universe. And I remember it was the very first time I had a sense, and it's almost an intimidating way, of the bigness of the universe. It's like it was the first time I was exposed to that. But at the same time, I became deeply intrigued by it, you know. So to the point that I've still never gotten a telescope. That's been something that's been on my agenda since I was six.
No excuse there. But I can tell you my version of that was I realized just how big the Earth was, all right? The fact that you had to get into an airplane and fly for hours at hundreds of miles an hour just to go to another country, to me, Earth was huge. And then to realize that Earth is small compared to the universe, I was already getting my huge mojo going there, you know, trying to contemplate things much larger than your backyard.
You know, another thing, I did do a little bit of research, found out you went to UT. I'm a native Texan, and I was like, hey, wait, you're a Longhorn?
Let's complete the origin story. So born and raised in New York City, attended the public schools all throughout the K through 12. My high school, however, was the Bronx High School of Science. I was born and raised in the Bronx. That high school boasts 8 Nobel laureates among its graduates. So it's quite the place for stimulating creative thinking. There, I went on to major in physics at Harvard, and then afterwards went to the University of Texas at Austin and got 2 master's degrees. From there, I went to Columbia University for my PhD in astrophysics. And from there, then I, what's called a postdoc, which is what you do after your PhD, you spend a few years in sort of free research, unfettered research. I postdoced at Princeton University. So that's probably how that showed up in your tally. And from there, I was courted by the American Museum of Natural History, who wanted to do something about the planetarium, which was growing long of tooth. And so I helped them rethink and reimagine the new place, got in some very creative architects, exhibit designers, and then I became director of that facility, which was the first place I'd ever seen a dark sky, was the Hayden Planetarium.
It begs the question of, were you wanting to do this at a young age, or was that something your parents were like, let's get him to this school, he's a smart guy, let's see where this takes us, or was that more something, was that a path that you kind of initiated, you know, like you wanted to go to this school?
So my parents would never put things ahead of us to try to attract us into one path of interest or another. Instead, what they did was expose us to all manner of things that talented adults do. Every weekend, my brother, my sister, and I went as family with my parents to some other place in the city. Was it the art museum, the aquarium, the science museum, the natural history museum, the planetarium, even sporting events? Was it hockey, basketball, football, the ice capades? These are all grown-ups with high-level talent doing things beyond just, oh, you want to be a doctor or a lawyer when you grow up. Out of that came an expression of my interest in the universe when I was 9 years old in a first visit to the Hayden Planetarium. My brother got interested in art from very early. He ended up attending the High School of Music and Art, and I ended up attending the Bronx High School of Science. It's not more
music
complicated.
Music and Art, was that the one they based the TV show Fame off of? Am I thinking of the
almost
right one?
Almost. Fame, they based it on the High School of Performing Arts, and that was a pair of high schools, Music and Art and Performing Arts, affectionately known as Ma and Pa, and they have since merged to become the Fiorello LaGuardia School of Arts, I guess. So Music and Art and Performing Arts have merged.
What got you to come down to do your, do you work at UT? Was it just kind of followed in line academically, or you just kind of wanted to kind of try?
Oh, UT has that a huge astronomy department. So for one, and by the way, I met who would become my wife there, who was getting a PhD in physics, mathematical physics. And so, so it was a good place to continue the astronomy. That's all. They had telescopes in West Texas, And it was quite a baptism for me. I'd never really hung out in the American Southwest, which has some of the DNA of the American South. And coming as a New Yorker, sort of liberal New Yorker, that was quite illuminating for me. Just to see all the guns everywhere and the Confederate flags and the, you know, there's just a lot of cultural exposure that I had never imagined would I'd be going through.
Yeah, Texas certainly that monolith, I think some think it is. You go to Austin or Dallas, totally different animal. I went to school at University of North Texas then, went to Texas Tech, and Tech is a great school, but Lubbock, West Texas, that's a you got to have that in your DNA to want to be.
You didn't say it right. It's Lubbock. You got to say it right. Lubbock.
There's a reason why there's a song that says, happiness is Lubbock in my rearview mirror. You know.
Oh, is that right? Okay.
But one of the things I was curious about is you're getting going early on. And I think most people, no matter the vocation, have somebody that they kind of cling on to as a North Star, you know, somebody that it's an inspiration or somebody you want to pattern yourself after. Did you have somebody like that in astrophysics, or was it kind of a melange of different people that inspired you?
Well, that assumes it was people at all. So it was first books. It was the first encounter with the night sky in the planetarium. Then my parents realized this was my interest, and they would frequent bookstores. I don't know if they still have these at bookstores, but there was always the remainder table where publishers would release excess copies of overprinted books. And they'd have a marking, a magic marker stripe against on their spine. And the books were 50 cents, 25 cents, 75 cents. My parents bought every book that had anything to do with physics, math, and astronomy. And so I had the largest library of any kid in my middle school for that reason. And so these books were my escape. These books were my window to the vast unknown. And so that fed my interest. In addition, I would take many more visits to the Hayden Planetarium, where you see more than just the space show. There are classes that are taught. There are special programs. There are lecture series. And I would consume all of that. And among that were educators and scientists on staff at the Hayden Planetarium who I knew I wanted to emulate. If I ever became an educator, I wanted the facility with words and storytelling that the educator on staff at the Hayden Planetarium had. And he was also had a beautiful sense of humor where you just smiled. You couldn't help but smile as you listened to everything that he said. And there was a scientist there who just knew so much. And here I am at age 14 and 15 saying to myself, I will never know as much science as they know, without realizing that they spent 4 years in college, another 6 years in graduate, 11 years focusing on something, and I'm only 15 years old. So I couldn't grasp how much I could learn given enough time and intensity. But so if you want to think of role models, mine were assembled a la carte. And I never wanted to be any single person. I think that's a flaw in the role model model, right? The role models, I want to be you. No, you want to have their expertise, or you want to have their talent. You want to have this thing about them. Do you want to actually be them? No, you are an individual. Stay that way. And that's how I've always felt.
You kind of translated the knowledge, the experience, into be it TV or radio, you know, Star Talk. How did you decide? It's like, okay, you've got this wonderful education. You're doing your thing. Did you have an itch to just kind of find different avenues to get this information out there and to educate?
No. I just enjoy knowing the universe and studying the universe. And that joy spills out, you know, as Carl Sagan once said, famously, I think, if you're in love, you want to tell the world. And so I'd be on an airplane and someone says, oh, what do you do? Oh, I do astrophysics. Oh, tell me about black holes and quasars and the Big Bang and God and, you know, all these questions. And I would monitor their eyebrows, right? Are their eyebrows like up and lit? Or are they looking sleepy while I'm giving this explanation versus another explanation? And I would gather sort of actively and passively a catalog of things people liked hearing about versus things that distract them or they get bored listening to. And I would hone future conversations with people to serve their curiosities and the curiosities that I was able to glean from these kinds of encounters. And I would do this, and then, you know, the press asked me a question one time, and then other press people saw that after it aired, and they started coming back. And one thing leads to another, and then, you know, you become the best friend of everybody who wants a good story on the meteor shower, or the demotion of Pluto, or the discovery of a black hole, or the eclipse. And I decided that if I had declined these overtures, I would be irresponsible. Because this is an authentic interest expressed by the public. And here I, in my chosen field, who am I to deny them the same pleasures that I have in learning about it all? So that's really how that unfolded.
Yeah, I really like that quote. You know, if you're in love, you want to tell the world. I've got to remember that one. That's good. I love that. You know, one of the things I was curious about is, what are your thoughts on lost knowledge? You look at the Egyptians, or you look at, you know, these people were very dialed into the cosmos, you know. Fast forward to now, do you think there are things that we are not aware of that were discovered previously and that information is just lost? What are your just general thoughts on that?
I think there's certainly cultural information. There's certainly information, regional information, because these are civilizations that survive centuries, if not a millennia, where they are. And some civilizations came and went, all right, and are just not there anymore. So something died with them, and you kind of want to know what that is. But to wonder whether they somehow had access to a scientific understanding of the physical universe that we do not today, that's not a feasible suggestion. That's not plausible. Only because, I mean, I'm not, because not because I want it to be true, but it's sensibly stated as fact because, as very likely fact, because so much of what we do know about the world was only enabled by the invention of methods and tools of science. The telescope, the microscope, the particle accelerator, space travel, space probes. Ancients had none of this. They only had their five senses, which are weak and feeble at best. At best, science and technology, engineering didn't take off until we could replace our five senses with machines that could do it better and faster and more accurately and more reliably. So no, there's not a bit of science that I'm imagining was known by the ancients and then lost, and we're still going to have to discover it one day. I don't think that for a minute.
Well, very good. Well, that kind of tethers together the second part of the question is, I'm trying to figure out a way to ask you without it sounding at all political, because it's not, but...
You can sound political. I don't care. We live in a world that has politics, right? So let's not stand in denial of that.
Well, in the U.S., depending on the century, you know, the idea of anti-intellectualism, you're a scientist, like you said, over the course of hundreds, millennia, we've come up with a scientific method. What do you think about generally anti-intellectualism? Do you think there is an aspect of that in our culture that kind of holds us back from where we could be?
Yeah, if we recognize science and technology as the engines of progress, however we might define that, and we could debate even that, but let's assume progress in civilization is something that's in the interest of your health and longevity. Okay, and harmony with the world. And what civilization has done, enabled, empowered by the methods and tools of science, especially since the Industrial Revolution, has greatly enhanced human health, wealth, and well-being. So if anyone wants to stand against the intellectual foundations that bring these discoveries to civilization, by the way, in a free society, sure, go ahead and do that. But if you rise to power, and then you have the power to legislate anti-intellectualism, then that's a regressive force on civilization, and you will delay future discoveries on what would happen. By the way, you can ask, why would someone like that even arise in the modern world? And I don't remember there being much anti-intellectualism in the 1960s, for example, when we were going to the moon. But I can tell you this, that I know a lot of people who are intellectuals, and they have like a disdain for those who are not. And that's not good. That can't end well. First, because intellectuals are outnumbered by non-intellectuals, so that's not going to end well. But if you're an intellectual and you can't have a conversation with someone without having them feel inferior to you, then you should just shut the fuck up, okay? go back to the lab and get out of the public. Pardon my language. I'm just saying that you're the attitude that so many people have who would count as intellectuals is counterproductive if you want people to embrace what it is intellectuals do. The very title intellectual carries a value judgment. And so when I give public talks, we introduce you. No, don't just say you're a personal astrophysicist. How about your degrees? Don't even put the degrees. How about your PhD? Don't. That's irrelevant. You know why it's irrelevant? Because if you need to know what degree I have to decide whether you're going to listen to what I say, then my arguments can't really be that compelling. The burden is on me to be compelling to you without regard to status, educational or otherwise. So that's how I think about this. So I think the intellectuals are half to blame for the anti-intellectual climate that we've seen in recent decades.
You had a wonderful quote. I found this somewhere. Don't even ask me where, because I don't remember. But if I'm misquoting you, please let me know. But I love this. You said the problem in society is not kids not knowing science. The problem is adults not knowing science. They outnumber kids 5-1. They wield power. They write your legislation. When you have scientifically literate adults, when you have scientifically illiterate adults, I need better glasses here, you have undermined the very fabric of what makes a nation wealthy and strong.
For context, that came off of a question. I've said that multiple ways in different ways, but often it comes off of the question, what do we need to do to get our kids interested in science? And I said, kids are born curious about the world. They're born scientists. I'm not worried about the kids. I'm worrying about the scientifically illiterate adults. And then it leads into that entire set of sentences that you accurately conveyed.
Like coming out with this book, again, let me go and make sure I say the title, Welcome to the Universe in 3D, a visual tour. Being turned on by what's out there is such an easy thing. It's infinite curiosity. There's infinite bigness, you know.
I got good material. The universe is good material. And by the way, that book is one in a series of four books. I don't know if I said it at the beginning. WelcomeToTheUniverse.net. That website has all four books, the most recent one in 3D, and that's the one that has my narration of the captions. But that entire series is an attempt to make the universe accessible to you in many different formats, because not everyone receives knowledge in the same way.
When I was younger, I remember watching the movie The Right Stuff. That era of space travel and that excitement, you talk about the 60s, that predated me a little bit, you know, to where I wasn't as aware of it, but I was really loved that movie. It brought me to NASA. I was always intrigued by NASA. Now we're living in an era where you've got private industry getting involved more directly. What are your thoughts about that kind of mix? How much should NASA be doing? How much should our billionaires be getting involved? But should NASA always be kind of leading the charge, you think, or do you think that private industry really is, it's going that direction?
That's a simple answer, actually. So you want NASA to do things that have never been done before. Private enterprise has no business model to justify doing things that have never been done before if that thing that has never been done before is expensive and dangerous and has no obvious return on the investment. Then they just simply won't do it. That you could do it as a vanity project, right? So Bezos and Branson can get together and say, let's put humans on Mars. They could do that. They have enough money to do that. But the shareholders in whatever pocket of money that's coming from would definitely object because there's no return on that investment. A nation can do that because a nation has geopolitical reasons for doing things. And they have a much longer time horizon for a return on their investment. In fact, they might not even need a return on their investment. The return might just be soft power projected around the world. It could be economic power. It could be anything. Okay, it could be an actual literal enemy, as we had in the Cold War. So, you need NASA to do things that have never been done before. And then once you can characterize the costs, the risks, the benefits, then private enterprise comes and does it. I was just so surprised when Elon Musk had a ship cargo resupply to the International Space Station, and the headline was, "New Era in Space, the Private Enterprise Taking Over the Thing." They're doing what NASA's been doing for 30 years. Okay, so yeah, let private enterprise do the routine things. And with proper business models, they could probably do it more cheaply and more efficiently and grow the industry. So the mix is very simple. If it's never been done before, you let NASA do it. Once NASA figures out how to do it, private enterprise comes in, see if they can make a buck.
You mentioned the moon and Mars. I don't know why I don't know this, but is there any kind of okay, we're going to go to moon, then Mars. Beyond that, I don't know what, is there a plan or is there a discussion for where are we going? What's the objective once we do get to Mars?
Yeah, you're thinking linearly, and as are most people, so no, I'm not accusing you of that. I'm just, I'm highlighting that fact. If instead you think in terms of capability rather than sequences of destinations, imagine a future where we have a warehouse of launch vessels, all right, of all combinations, and you tell me what you want to do. Oh, you want to look for life on the, in the craters of Mars. Well, that's this combination of rockets. And it's a science mission, so you get funding for that from the National Science Foundation or from NASA, and then you go look for life on Mars. You want to set up an amusement park on the moon where all the rides are in 1/6 G. That'll be kind of fun, okay? So that's this set of things, and now you need habitat modules. And you want to mine an asteroid for its natural resources and the rare earth elements that are common on an asteroid, even if they're rare on Earth. That's this combination of launch vehicles. Oh, you want to sell water to everyone else who is in space without having to bring it from Earth. So you're going to lasso a comet. Okay, let's go ahead and do that. Melt the ices, sell liters of water to whoever needs it in orbit. Wait a minute, there's an asteroid headed our way. We need somebody to deflect it. Oh my gosh, maybe the military is involved. That's a different set of vehicles, a different set of launch parameters, a different set of tools necessary once you arrive there. Oh, you want to beam energy from the sun back to Earth from a special Lagrangian point. You're going to build that in free space. That's not on the surface of anything. That's a whole other task. You add all of this up. These are capabilities brought to you by a warehouse of launch vehicles. That's what I imagine the future of our relationship to space will be.
Yeah, it's kind of sort of like instead of just like a lab, we kind of look at our solar system as one just big lab kind of.
A backyard. I wouldn't have to say lab. You might want to just joyride. That's not a lab. You don't have to think of this scientifically if it can make a buck.
I'm all down with going to that amusement park on moon. That actually, it seems like, you get Disney enough. Disney, I got a couple bucks. They'll figure it out one way or another.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
When you were talking about that, it reminds me, I don't know if you ever have seen the TV show The Expanse.
So that's on my list, by the way. In the next month, I'm going to binge, and I expect to get through all of them. I know that several years of them. But it's on my list.
I'm not going to spoil it for you at all. I just think it's the most eloquent blend of science, sociology, psychology. I mean, you look at it like, what if, I was talking with my kids the other day about it. What if we put humans on Mars? Hopefully, it's going to happen one day. But let's say they're there a few decades, 100 years, let's say a generation.
But by the way, they said that in 1969. We'll have people on Mars by 1985. So you have to ask yourself, what is motivating you to presume that to be true? And once you do that analysis, don't be so certain that we'll just have people frolicking on Mars. Just don't be so certain.
Yeah, I'm trying to be infinitely optimistic and just hoping one day. I'll hope one day we actually get to that.
That's better. That's a more accurate statement. Go. Mm-hmm.
Let's say we land there decades or a generation or two. I'm fascinated by the sociology, the psychology of it. We're there, but what's their connection? Two generations down, like, do they consider themselves Martians?
If you're born on Mars, you're a Martian. You'd have to ask, what is your citizenship? Do you have a citizenship? Is it a Mars government? If, you know, if it's not Earth government and someone kills somebody else, is it murder? If there are no laws that say it's murder on Mars, is it a Wild West? These all need to be resolved.
By the way, I love the. It was one of those things I put off, and I finally started binging it. I thought it was so well done. I'm kind of a nerd, so it satisfied that side as well as me being an actor.
You don't have to confess being a nerd. Wear it proudly.
But the thing I'm curious about is what sci-fi show, movie, what do you think has gotten it pretty right in terms of the science? What has come out of Hollywood do you think has been on point? Who's gotten the science right?
So definitely The Martian. No question. There's almost no contest there. The author was an engineer. Andy Weir, he's an engineer, and he thought long and deep and hard about how to keep Mark Watney alive for 2 years on Mars. The botany, the engineering, the astrophysics, the mathematics, all of this. And for me, that film, which had marquee director and marquee actors in it, was the first of its kind in that science itself was a character in the film. You wanted to know what the science was going to do next, more than you cared about every one of these space movies there's the astronaut in there, and they have a newborn back on Earth, and they're touching the video screen. And look at your new daughter. And I'm thinking, could you hurry that up, please? I want to know if Mark Watney's going to live another day. So other than one scientific flaw, which was necessary, otherwise that was not a story, the rest was just brilliantly done. Another one is Deep Impact. Very good asteroid science in that. Excellent science, asteroid science. And another one, very close in time to that one, was Contact, based on the Carl Sagan novel. That doesn't take place in the future, it's in the present, but it's an exploration of how we might all respond to such a discovery if it happened in our times. And not all of it is pretty. I think Carl was very honest with ourselves about how we would treat that information.
Yeah, the sociology of it, they had of course, Matthew McConaughey, you have somebody theological, you got science, you have, money involved. And I love movies that have you asking questions afterwards, and have you contemplating things you didn't before.
Well, that way they get you to see it twice, you see, and then they get twice the revenue.
What I love having kids, I got three teenagers, I can go back to this whole bank of movies, and I'm like, you must watch this movie, and it's so good. And I'm realizing all these movies came out they still haven't seen, but Interstellar, I remember taking my oldest, who's now 19, to go see that. And because at some level, that was, to me, it's kind of a daddy-daughter movie. At some level, there's a storyline in there, but it really was intriguing the way they address black holes, which brings me to the question. The idea that black holes destroy data and information is one theory, and then there's another theory. It's like, no, it's just, it still exists. It just goes somewhere. What is the current theory on what happens when something goes into a black hole?
We're leaning towards the idea that black holes do not destroy information, that all the information that passes through the event horizon is remembered and, in fact, encoded on the event horizon itself. All information. This is the emergent understanding based on what the theories of physics are telling us. That these are theories of physics that are well tested in other realms. And so we're extrapolating into new realms with the same theories. So the confidence we have derives from how successful these theories have been in other regimes.
Because isn't there a theory the multiverse or alternate universes that may exist? Isn't there a theory that black holes may be some kind of portal or link, or is that still just purely theoretical?
Yeah, if you look at it's all theoretical. Don't just say it's just theoretical, because equals MC squared is Einstein's theory of relativity, and you make bombs out of that. So there's never an occasion to denigrate something being theoretical if it's been tested and supported. So here's, if you follow the math into the black hole, what happens is an entire other space-time opens up in front of you as the one behind you closes off. And so, yes, black holes may indeed be portals to whole other... I guess we can call them universes, sure, because they don't connect with the one you just came from. But it's intriguing, and this is highly untapped material for science fiction.
Well, what do you think is a good book or a movie or explanation when somebody says time-space? It's kind of hard to get... Even I sometimes have a hard time getting my head around it.
No, it's easy. I'll tell you why. If I say, hey, let's go have lunch tomorrow at 12 noon, you say, sure. What's your next question to me?
Where?
You intuitively know that the time coordinate is incomplete in order to assure that the two of us meet up for lunch. Okay? I'm in New York City. Those are sirens, right? You know that intuitively. Okay? So now I say, hey, let's go meet at the corner deli tomorrow for breakfast. And what's your next question to me?
Corner deli tomorrow for breakfast, it'd be what time?
What time? So the first case, I gave you a place, a time, but not a place, and you said, I need the place. And next time I gave you the place, but not a time, you said, I need the time. This is evidence that we live in a space-time world. Space and time only have meaning in our lives when they connect in what we call world lines. Your world line is your movement through space and time at all times. It's why when you cross a street, you're not flattened by the truck that was in the very same spot you are, because it's not in the same spot at the same time. So world lines are this ingenious way to understand the world so that everything doesn't all happen in the same place at the same time. Now, one thing that Zoom calls have done during the pandemic, a silver lining there is, it has removed the time coordinate that is normally required for people to connect. It's removed the space coordinate. All you need is a time coordinate. Zoom call tomorrow at noon. I don't care where you are in the world. You dial into the Zoom call, and we're there. So it's a remarkable, if you want to think about it on a deeper level, a Zoom call is our space-time coordinates intersecting without space being a parameter in that intersection.
It's when I hear space-time, I never really got a full definition to where I understand.
No, yeah, just you overthink it. It's simple.
Now, Cosmos, my kids grew up on it, and it's funny because I remember being younger and Carl Sagan. Did you ever have a chance to sit down and spend time with Carl Sagan?
So people like to describe him as my mentor, but I was probably only in his company maybe four times in my life, maybe five times in my life. And so again, it wasn't about role models as people. It was about whoever they were and whatever they did, was it something worth emulating? And then you emulate it. Whether or not they're standing next to you as a coach, you know, if you study someone hard enough, you can figure out how they do it and why and what motivates them and what they do that would best fit for how you do it or how you want to do it. So, we were never beer drinking buddies, but we knew each other, yes.
Well, did Seth MacFarlane, did he approach you with this idea, or who knocked on whose door about the idea of bringing back Cosmos in its current incarnation?
So Andruyan is the Carl Sagan's widow. She's the secret sauce of all three Cosmoses. She's, though not a scientist herself, she is deeply connected to what it is to be scientifically literate. And she doesn't simply know the universe, she feels the universe. Almost every amazing line to come out of Cosmos, all three Cosmoses, almost every line where you just have to pause and say, wow, I feel that. It's traceable to Andruyan. And so she and I met as serving on the board of the Planetary Society, an organization that Carl Sagan co-founded back in 1980. And the conversation came up about whether Cosmos would be resurrected. And then she asked, would I be interested in hosting that? And I said, no, there's probably a dozen people who want to host that. I don't need to host it. But then I thought, wait, I have certain memories of Carl Sagan, though we only spent four occasions together. That first one was hugely influential, which was when he sent me a letter when I was in high school to ask me to visit Cornell to see if I want to go to Cornell for college. It was a stupefying thing. It was like, what is it? What? Who would do this? He did it. To this day, I treat students the way he treated me, giving them time in the middle of your day, no matter how busy your day is. And so, can't do that with all students, but I do when the time, I do it. And so, he probably did it better and more consistently than I've been able to, just to, if you want to rank that. But I said, okay, if you want me, I'd be happy to do this. Okay. So then we all agree, we'll resurrect Cosmos. We got the original co-writer, Steve Soter, and along with Andrewian. And so there it was. But then we started knocking on doors to see who would. We went to PBS. We went to Discovery Channel. We went to a bunch of places. And they all wanted to assign their own writers to it. I think they felt that the original Cosmos needed some sprucing up. Get a young writer in there, and they'll know what to say and how to do it. And Andrewian would have none of that. She knew she had a vision statement of what she wanted and how it would look. And though she was 35 years older than when she first co-authored it, she was not responsive to their requirements to do this. At the time, I became friends with Seth MacFarlane through something called the Science Entertainment Exchange, an actual branch of the National Academy of Sciences. We got to know each other, and he came up to me and says, you know, I came into some money recently. Is there any good I can do? And I said, oh, my gosh, why don't you, fund a pilot for Cosmos so we can show people what it's going to look like? And then the sponsors would come. And he says, no, I have a better idea. Why don't I just take it to Fox? Because all his shows are on Fox. And I said, no, that's a terrible idea. I was thinking in my head, you know, Cosmos on Fox, that's not going to work. This is a mistake. Sorry I asked. But then I thought about it for 10 seconds. Wait a minute. Fox is huge, way bigger than PBS. And a lot of liberals think of Fox as just Fox News, but Fox is Fox flagship, which has the liberally acerbic Simpsons on it and Family Guy. And they had... what's that highly progressive show? Glee. All right. These are all Fox programmings. Another show called In Living Color. And so I said, this is a brilliant idea. So we took it to Fox and they bought in. And they said, we'll do 13 episodes. And we trust that you know what you're doing. And so they didn't even want to put a writer on it. Okay. And so that's how it landed on Fox. Then Fox bought National Geographic. And then it landed on Fox and National Geographic at the same time. Then Disney bought both Fox and National Geographic, and now you want to find Cosmos, it's on Disney Plus.
As a parent who's, I've always been really into this space, learning is something I've always drunk up really easily, and I'm jazzed that my kids kind of got that same bug a little bit. Like I said, my daughter said, why don't you talk to Neil deGrasse Tyson? And I was like, sure. Yeah, I certainly appreciate you being generous with your time. It means a lot to me, certainly, and I got these 7 questions I like to ask. The first question is, what is your favorite comfort food? That thing that like brings you back to your center, you know, you just can sit down, munch on it, whatever, or maybe a thought, it brings you back home.
You said munch and implied something crunchy. A strawberry malted milkshake, solid food, a New York pepperoni pizza. Those two, I could go to Mars on those two food groups. I have them every single day, and I would not get tired. I would not grow tired of them.
Now, if you're going to sit down, have a cup of coffee, 3 people, either alive or in history, just to talk story for a few hours, who would those 3 people be?
I would say Joan of Arc, Isaac Newton, and maybe Martin Luther King Jr. Yeah. These are people who represent sort of extreme, you know, 2 of them gave their lives, right? For what they believed in. And I just want to know what it feels like to think so strongly about something that your life doesn't even matter. Because the cause is greater than your own life. And that cause is for the progressive, you know, the cause is a good cause, not some other cause. you know, the Nazis had a cause. That's not the kind of cause I'm talking about here. And so, and Isaac Newton, just for his sheer brilliance, I think he's the smartest person to ever walk the face of the earth.
Now, as a kid growing up, who was your celebrity crush?
I didn't really have celebrity crushes. I wasn't really into that. I liked baseball players. I wanted to be Ron Bloomberg was the very first designated hitter in all of baseball for the New York Yankees. And I loved how often he hit home runs and longs. So, I, you know, and as a kid growing up in the Bronx, home of the Yankees, of course, I wanted to play for the Yankees when I grew up. I wanted to hit the way he hit the ball. I enjoyed that.
Well, you answered my second question, Mets or Yankees. So that's...
Oh, yeah. Duh. Didn't I say I was from the Bronx? Dude. Okay. So no, I didn't really have a celebrity crush. I had a crush on my seventh grade math teacher. How about that?
You know, I had one of my eighth grade English teacher, but she was a Dallas Cowboy cheerleader. So, you know, it was... let me tell you, eighth grade boys and a Dallas Cowboy cheerleader as a teacher.
That's a bad mixture right there. Yeah, yeah.
Indeed. Now, let's say you're going to be going to an island, or let's say you're going
resort. Let me back up. I had a crush. I guess we could call it a crush. I was a big fan of the TV series I Dream a Genie. And it couldn't have just been a crush on Barbara Eden because he was an astronaut going into space at NASA, and I was already interested in the universe. So this was like double dipping for me, right? Because she's beautiful and she has huge powers that are just mind-bogglingly, staggeringly amazing, and he's an astronaut. So I guess I had a crush. I enjoyed the show for all of those reasons combined.
I was kind of, honestly, I was kind of the same way. I was into the space thing and, you know. And then when I was a kid, one of the first acting jobs I ever did was Dallas. I was 7 years old. So it was kind of wild seeing
him. Well, with my guy, yes. With Major Nelson was star of Dallas, yes.
Yeah, he was the 80s in Dallas. That was a whole different story.
And tell me his name on that show again. His name was...
J.R. Ewing.
J.R., yeah, who shot J.R.? Yeah. I remember that. Mm-hmm.
Now, if you were to go from the time you get up to the time you put your head down to go to sleep, if you have a perfect day, what are some of the component parts of that perfect day for you?
Oh, so I would make a brunch for the whole family, and then we might go somewhere fun, just somewhere with nothing to do, like to the beach or hiking. I'm less a fan of hiking than I am laying on the beach doing nothing, but there's that. Curl up all together, make popcorn with slightly too much butter on it, and watch a movie that none of us have seen yet, and then have a nice barbecue dinner. And that's a day with family. A day at work, I would wake up, knock out about 500 emails. I get, you know, 1,500 a day or so. And then, you know, check my calendar, get some things done, allocate 3 or 4 hours for quality writing. I enjoy having written, as they say, and so you need good time slots for that. There's an old saying, which I didn't want to agree with, but I think it's deeply true. If you want to be creative, you have to become less productive. So don't think of your day as a good day if you got a lot of stuff done. Think of a day where you don't get anything done, but you did a lot of thinking, a lot of creative thinking. There's no substitute for that.
It's kind of like the Greeks back in the day. You know, they probably sat around just contemplating, you know,
thinking. That kind of thing. Yes, salons where you just sort of trade ideas in ways that you don't fight about the ideas because you really want to know how the other person thinks.
Man, we need more of that.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Now, if you were not doing what you're doing now for a living, what would be choice number two? What would you be doing?
Well, it doesn't work that way for me. It'd have to be another universe because I don't have the talent to do what I would do next. So it have to be another universe where I'd have that talent. So I would write songs for Broadway musicals.
So do you check out musicals regularly? Or
Yeah, I love them. Love them. I love the perfectly composed sentence sung in a way that rhymes, but doesn't feel forced. And it communicates information and advances the plot. that takes brilliance to do that.
Especially when it's perfectly scored.
Correct. Yeah, and I can't score music. So this is a whole other world that I'd be in, right? A music world that I'm not in right now.
Well, I've got one last question before the youngin' has a question for you. But DeLorean, jump in. You're going back to when you were 16 years old, and you have a couple minutes to share a piece of wisdom, guidance, advice, whatever have you, that is going to put you maybe on a better rail or maybe get you where you want to be faster, better, more comfortably, whatever you want to put it. But what's that piece of advice to your 16-year-old self?
I object to the question because it assumes... Yeah. No, I'll tell you why. It assumes that there's a lesson that I could be told about instead of experience, and having been told about it would be as impactful on my life as having experienced it. My life is, anybody's life, is only about the sum of your life experiences. And your life experiences define who you are. The mistakes you made, the triumphs you've had, the turmoil, the struggles, all of those go into who and what you are. If someone says, do this, don't do that, do this, don't do that, then what am I at the end of that? Having not experienced it, just being told it. So I would not trade my life experiences for anything. So no, I would go back to my 16-year-old and say, keep going. Doing what you're doing. That would be the advice, if you want to think of it that way.
Or maybe don't doubt what you're doing. Just keep on going.
No, that's not, nope. Doubt is, you need to doubt sometimes. Am I really into this? Do I really want this? Doubt has value because it can strengthen your resolve for having had doubt in the first place. You can't have someone come up to you and say, don't doubt it. Okay, therefore I'm not going to doubt it. The question is flawed in the actual real world. Unless you're a person who keeps making the same mistake, then you could use someone slap you in the head. Say, don't make that same mistake 9 times in a row, okay? But if you learn from your mistakes, that is the character profile of who and what you become as you get older. Period.
Very good. Well, you know, when I was speaking with a good friend of mine who is big, he is the ultimate Star Trek fan, loves everything space. He had a good friend of mine, Trey Elliott, back home in Texas, whose son's going to your alma mater right now, UT. He had one question, two part. He said, just quick thought, not the men and women serving, but the idea and concept of Space Force and the idea that they're using the Star Trek logo. Do you have any thoughts on that?
It's a variation on a Star Trek logo. It's inspired by the Star Trek logo. They're not actually using the Star Trek logo. We've always had a Space Force. It was called the Air Force Space Command, and we've had it, you know, since the dawn of satellites. So this is like an accounting shift. People say, oh my gosh, we'll militarize space. The military has been in space ever since we've had satellites. That's what spy satellites are. That's what any of that, that's what GPS is. It was launched by the Air Force to give coordinates for missiles and anyone else navigating where there aren't navigation lines, street signs, like, for example, the ocean or the desert, all right? So don't overreact to the existence of the Space Force.
So you said it's just an accounting shift. I got you. Well, tell you what, if you don't mind, I have one question. My little one here, he's my height, has for you.
Oh, cool. Hello. Hey, how old are you?
17.
17, cool.
If time travel is theoretically possible, does that mean our pasts and our futures are currently existing right now?
So if we can imagine traveling both forward and backwards in time, such that time is just like a coordinate, like you walk out on the street and you can go uptown or downtown, right? Or you can go east and west. If time is just a coordinate, then it makes sense to think of your life as always existing. You're always being born, you're always being 17, you're always a grandfather, you're always dying. And then you just reoccupy that same timeline, world line, if you will, and then you live out your life that it pre-exists. In the same way the street pre-exists. It doesn't change every time you go out there. But if, let's say, you cannot go backwards in time, but we know you can go forwards in time with relativity, there had to be some rule that's preventing it. And Hawking imagined what do you call it? Time travel conjecture, where, you know, if you go back in time and prevent your parents from meeting, then you're never born, so that you can't go back in time to prevent your parents from meeting. So that's a paradox. So he said there must be some law of physics of the universe that prevents you from going back in time, because you can't let that happen. So if that's the case, then you can think of us as not on a pre-existing timeline, but always forever transitioning from an inaccessible past to an unknowable future.
Dr. Tyson, again, thank you for being generous with your time. Best of luck. Again, the book, Welcome to the Universe in 3D, a visual tour, part of four books, and it's welcometotheuniverse.net, correct?
You can find them all there, exactly.
What a cool guy. Really enjoyed the chat with Neil deGrasse Tyson, and very cool. My son had a chance to, you know, come in, ask a question. My kids grew up watching Cosmos, so this was kind of a neat thing for him, and of course for me, and of course for you as well. So if you're kind of a space nerd like me, this had to be a lot of fun. Don't forget the book he has out. It is really neat. It is called Welcome to the Universe in 3D, a Visual Tour. It's an interactive book, a little something different than you're used to. I think it's something kind of neat to get a kid who is into space stuff. Space stuff, that's the technical term, you see. And as he mentioned, you want to catch Cosmos, Disney Plus is where you can find Cosmos right now. Once again, thank you very much for being here for this episode. I got two episodes for you a week, Tuesdays and Thursdays. So don't forget about that. Twice a week, I'm all up in your podcast app. And don't forget storyandcraftpod.com. Send me a message, voicemail, sign up for the newsletter, also social media. Everything about Story and Craft is at storyandcraftpod.com. Thank you again for being here. I really appreciate it more than you know. Looking forward to chatting with you next time right here on Story and Craft.
That's it for this episode of Story and Craft. Join Mark next week for more conversation right here on Story and Craft. Story and Craft is a presentation of Mark Preston Productions, LLC. Executive producer is Mark Preston. Associate producer is Zachary Holden. Please rate and review Story and Craft on Apple Podcasts. Don't forget to subscribe to the show on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Spotify, or your favorite podcast app. You can subscribe to show updates and stay in the know. Just head to storyandcraftpod.com and sign up for the newsletter. I'm Emma Dillon. See you next time, and remember, keep telling your story. Come on.